jumps around. Transportation Policy Committee will come to order. We have been informed that we have a roll, we're taking the roll call, and we find that we have a quorum. So I will ask, Representative Petersburg, would you like to take a shot at getting our minutes of February 5th and 6th approved?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I approve the minutes as presented.
Are there any questions or concerns about that? Otherwise, all in favor of okay in the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. Next item is Representative Quam with House File, presenting House File 123. Do you have a witness, Representative, as well? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are several people from MnDOT. There is one on your agenda as a witness.
Well, let's see. We need a move to place this on our agenda and be recommended to pass and refer to the Transportation Finance Committee. Representative Mason, would you like to make that motion?
So move.
Okay, Representative Crom, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a fairly short bill, as you can see, and it's started with a, myself driving around, noticing where there were some developments, noticing many of the improvements that MnDOT's done to, high traffic areas with accesses, overpasses, etc. And I noticed that in some there were properties and businesses that had been added after a few years, and in others there weren't. And so I asked a few developers and people across the state that, are there really, some properties out there that could go back on the tax rolls, and is there a system? Did some research, discovered that there was in statute a process right now that a year after a project's complete, you would look at, as in MnDOT would look at, see if there were any excess properties, and look at selling it. There was another process that wasn't really statutorily firm that allowed for, say, cities or counties or entities to go to MnDOT and say, we'd like this parcel to go back on the tax rolls and be available. And I also had, over the years read in the papers where there had been, some lawsuits and other litigation over, a dispute of being able to bring a property back from, underneath MnDOT to the property rolls. And I thought, in order to avoid some of the litigation and to provide a more structured process, that we ought to have a bill. So I started out with a very short bill, and I invited MnDOT to come in and visit with me, and they actually did the work to draft the amendment, and I don't have a copy of the amendment before me, but I would, here it is. It's the DE1 amendment, and at an appropriate time, I'd like that moved as an author's amendment to get this into the appropriate form.
All right, we'll move that, and you can explain that.
Actually, I may ask, since MnDOT drafted it, as to what the improvements are, it might be better if they said that, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, I missed that one.
Since MnDOT drafted this, the agency drafted this amendment, yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd prefer if they maybe would speak to the changes from the bill?
Yeah. I know if this is backwards, but I'm going to have you explain it, and then we'll vote to include it. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and I think the main change between the amendment and the original bill is that the legislation would now apply to property that is surplus and suitable for sale. So in other words, we would look at what is out there and make some determination as to whether it's suitable for use, and if it's not, then we would stop the process at that point. So hopefully this would limit the amount of work that would be required by the department. The other change is that the legislation originally had a report due in even-numbered years. The amendment changes that to being due in odd-numbered years so that we would have an additional year to compile this information before we're expected to report back to the legislature. The bill, as introduced, would create a lot of additional work for the department, and certainly the even as amended, there would be a great deal of additional effort, but we feel that with the amendment incorporated, it's something that we'd be able to manage.
Do you have any idea what kind of, how many holdings, parcels, or land we're talking about here? I don't think MnDOT ever gives up a nickel's worth of land without a struggle here, so I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, actually, if we don't need land for a transportation purpose, we're actually very happy to get rid of it and sell it to whoever would like to obtain it or give it back to the original property owner if that person is interested in having it back. We actually don't have a very good record of all of the holdings across the state, and so the department has been around since the 1970s, Department of Transportation, but certainly there were lots of roads and highways in the state that were around long before the department existed, and we are now maintaining that system, but those records go back to the early part of the last century. So we don't actually have a very good record of everything that the department controls, at least in a centralized location. So we really hesitate to venture a guess, I think, at this point as to how many parcels we might be talking about.
Well, Mr. Rudine, are you aware of any such sales that have been made in the last 5 years?
Mr. Chair, certainly we've had instances in the last 5 years where we've been able to sell excess property. There is a process today, as Representative Quam alluded to, where if somebody is interested in a specific parcel, they can come to us, and we will then determine whether that parcel is needed for a transportation purpose. If it's not, then we have a process that's laid out in the statute that we have to follow, where we first have to go to the previous landowner and see if they're interested in having the property back. If they're not interested, then we would talk to local governments and see if they are interested in obtaining the property. If they're not, then it goes up to a public bid. So that has happened, and it happens on an ongoing basis, but I think the intent of the bill is to have the department be more proactive. So rather than just doing that in the instances where we have a specific request, we would sort of go out and try to get rid of things that are not being used.
Representative Petersburg, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seemed to me like it would make some sense even for the department to initiate that on themselves, because there is got to be some maintenance in regards to these holdings of weed control and other things that the department has to do. So even if there is some upfront costs, I would think that would be offset by the reduction in maintenance on those particular areas. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, yes, I think that is a fair statement. As I said, we are not interested in holding on to property that we don't need, and specifically for those reasons.
Representative Slaser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really like the intent of this bill. I think it is a great idea. I just have a question. Could you just give me some examples of what the transportation purposes would be or what the definition would be? I'm sure it's broad enough so that we wouldn't at some point in time think, darn, I wish we hadn't sold that particular parcel. So I'm just wondering about that.
Mr. Reddy?
Mr. Chair, there are several examples that we could give. One would be snow storage, for example. If there's a bridge that needs to be cleared, and the snow from the bridge needs to be stored off the end of the bridge somewhere, there might be a parcel that is apparently not being used for other things, but then during the winter it would be used for snow storage. That would be one example. Another example might be where we have a two-lane highway today, but we're intending in our long-term plans to upgrade that facility to four lanes. It would make more sense to hold on to the property until such time as we're ready to upgrade it to four lanes, rather than sell it today and then come back 10 years from now and reacquire it at a higher price. So those would be a couple of examples.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam, and to the testifier, possibly a couple of questions, if I may. I'm assuming that the majority of this property is acquired through eminent domain. Is that a fair statement, or is that just a small percentage of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is Brian Dodds. I'm the Director of Land Management for MnDOT. And we typically acquire about 80% of our parcels through direct purchase. So only 20% are acquired using the power of eminent domain, approximately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up.
Representative Simonson.
In the bill, it talks about reporting back to this committee with your findings or your report. Can you explain to me what the purpose of coming back to this committee with this list of properties would be?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The intent is, you know, first of all, to do the inventory and to do a periodic assessment so that we keep on top of that, and letting, you know, the committees and legislature know sort of what the plans are and change, so you'll be able to see an evolution like 494, you know, that corridor. You've got discussions about, you know, future plans, and this would allow you maybe a better view of the evolution and the process that MnDOT's going through, and so you've gained that more insight and partnership with them. And that's part of the reason why going from, you know, the 1 year that's in statute to, you know, 5 years, and I'm very open if there's a better time period. But basically, there are a lot of what ifs, as they said, snow. Maybe you haven't had a big snow. Maybe you haven't had a big rain, and you're not sure what you might need for, you know, land around that area. And so as things evolve and change, and the discussion and path with the legislature, I think that partnership will help us do, you know, better planning in your other bills, and then also help MnDOT to understand in that discussion better what the legislature feels about their evolving plans.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. first, just a thought, Representative Quam, in knowing that MnDOT's got parcels, pieces of parcels all over the place, and I'm remembering Mr. Boudin last year or 2 years ago, there was discussion about a long, thin strip of land that MnDOT took the whole thing, but at the end didn't need 5 or 6 feet, and the landowner wanted it back. And I don't remember. I just remember the interesting discussion about who knows and how do they know that these parcels are actually out there. So I'm thinking about the other way. Instead of having MnDOT inventory them and bring them back to us, is there a way that interested landowners know about these things and come to us and say, we want MnDOT to sell this back to us, or yield it back or something like that. Mr. Rudine, I'm thinking particularly of the district I represent. When we built the 169 bypass, there were large parcels of property taken, an entire neighborhood was taken, and some of that land has been held now for nearly 30 years. However, in one case, an interchange is being built, and we needed some of that land. In another case, it turned out something didn't happen that was anticipated 20-some years ago, and the city actually acquired the property from MnDOT for a fire station. How is there another way that people pry these loose from your tight clutches, or isn't your clutch that tight? Do you go out and knock on doors and say, hey, this could be available? Talk to us a little bit about how this might be accomplished other than having us know about it and force you into action. Or maybe your land manager can, and maybe that's a better person.
Mr. Chair,
Rudine, yeah?
I'll take a first shot at it, and then Mr. Dodds can maybe add. But as I mentioned before, if someone comes to us and is interested in a particular piece of property, we will then begin the process to evaluate whether it's needed for current or future transportation use. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then we're happy to dispose of it from our possession. But really, without in contacting the department, it's probably difficult for most people to know exactly where the property boundaries are, and in some cases we would probably need to go out and do a survey to determine exactly where the property boundaries are. But certainly there are sources of information, whether through MnDOT or through counties, that do have records of who the property owner is mm-hmm. in a particular location. And so certainly somebody from the public could look on a county website probably and determine who owns the property in a particular area. But maybe I'll let Mr. Dodds add to that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Now we typically do it on a case-by-case basis. It's an opportunity-based system. Starting with our acquisitions, we try not to take more than we need. We'll buy fee or permanent easement for where the road is or where we have a drainage pond or need permanent snow storage. But if there are areas outside of that we need to do some grading or some other minor work just during construction, we'll get a temporary easement. So we typically seek just to buy what we need. And if there are cases where the road has changed or the needs have changed over time and there's perhaps a part of a property where we don't need it, someone approaches us, more than happy to get into a discussion with them. We have to follow our statutory requirements, offer to the person who used to own it. A lot of times we talk to the local public agency that has jurisdiction. But we do, like to dispose of those. I see a couple of those a week come through. So they're out there. And again, it's opportunity based. We're focused on program delivery, trying to meet our letting date and get our projects out in a timely manner. And when we get these other requests, they're kind of a secondary priority.
There's suspicion around the table here that you are hiding millions of dollars in unused land. I think that's what our question is. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As was alluded to, there is sort of a piecemeal process in existence, and the initial inventory, even though there's there has been a fiscal note generated because in the Senate it's going to the fiscal committee, but frankly, if we have it organized, it's much more efficient to go through, get that inventory, and then do a well-structured and efficient reevaluation than handling it piecemeal. Plus, if someone is coming and wanting options, that whether it's a city or a developer, and is asking, is this land available, because of this activity, they'll be able to quickly reference, and they already have that information and can answer, don't have to do a survey, don't have to, et cetera, that can delay. And that way government can be more responsive in answering the yes or no. And I think that improved relationship is a win-win.
Are there any other questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could go to the issue of the reports, Mr. Chair, and I'm just becoming aware of how many reports, you know, MnDOT is required to do to the legislative committees, it looks like. So there's, you know, numerous reports. And is this like all of those? This will be just another report? They don't actually come here to be heard and presented before our committee, but our committee is free to decide and ask for certain reports to be presented, or what is the typical handling of the reports by the committee?
I think that it requires the report to come to this committee. In fact, they're both grant policy and finance committee by March 1st of each odd number of years, so I would think it would appear on whoever's chair of the committee's doorstep, and they found anything startling, they could certainly raise the question with the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, then, is that the same language that the other reports that MnDOT generates, that they too are meant to go to the committee? I mean, there must be a 20 of them that I've, you know, received an email about in the last, since December. Maybe Mr. Burris would know.
Have you read all of the reports that they sent you?
Well, I open them.
Mr. Burris, you have any suggestions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, this language is similar to other provisions that are set in statutes requiring submission of reports by MnDOT. I don't have a exact number, but it is more than tens, and probably somewhere in the 20s. The typical method of submission these days is for MnDOT to email an electronic copy to all of the committee members and post the report on the website. Historically, the transportation committees have had some hearings on some of the reports, and other reports have just been made available to perusal by committee members and staff and the general public.
It would seem that there is no ready source of inventory on these. That's what I'm hearing from the testimony, so maybe it's a good idea. What else we got? Representative Simonston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of follow-up questions. And generally, I think I understand the intent and agree with the concept of this. It does make some sense to me. But my specific question might be to you, Representative Quam, but the fiscal note that we have in our packet. Does it reflect the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the changes here were more technical, and when I had, you know, the person that generated, you know, active in generating a fiscal note is present, but my interpretation from discussions is that it would still be valid, and that fiscal note does not take into account revenues generated by the land sales, and since it's in the magnitude of a few $100,000, it wouldn't take very many property sales to recoup that. And we have already had discussions, I have and MnDOT, about how to, if we need to have a, you know, something added that says the first dollars from any sales, that revenue will go to cover the expenses incurred in doing the inventory and this process. And again, I have the intent, because I think the idea is good, but I have been soliciting the, you know, input, improvements, and compatibility with MnDOT in existing processes and how we can, you know, be least disruptive. And I am very open to any of the members of the committee on how to improve this bill. I just saw maybe a gap that we could do things better, and so I'm trying to facilitate that. So if you had any thing I could work offline, or you know, oral amendments. You know, once we you do vote on this you know, author's amendment, I am very open to that.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. I do appreciate that, and again, I like the intent of this, and I like where we're going with this, and I like that we're going to have a list moving forward into the future. My only concern, and this is probably just from the tax side of me, if we're going to invest this amount of money, which makes sense to me from a policy standpoint, I would just like to have some assurance that we're going to get some return on our investment. And I'm hearing that we probably are, but if I could maybe just get the three of you to nod your heads and say, yes, we will get this money back, I would probably just relax. Thank you.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Compliments to Representative Quam. If this puts some of these land parcels back in the tax rolls, that can only be a good thing for the local communities and the state. Mm-hmm. But to the testifiers and Representative Quam, these land sales, as you indicated, were nothing new to the DOT, but I'd like to know roughly how many tracts have been sold in the recent years on the market, and how much money has been generated as a result of those sales.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Mr. Dodge,
thank you. I don't have a summary list right now. This last year was probably in the 20 some odd parcels that were sold. Many of those went to cities and counties, and a few were to private property owners. But I don't have a list, but we could get that for you if you request that.
That'll only make sense. Mr. Chairman, that'll only make sense. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, this question is for you. I'm sorry I was late. I was getting my ear bent out in the hall, but what was the motion on this bill? We moved it to just get in front of the committee, or we moved it to go somewhere?
Transportation Finance.
Go to Finance next, so we have a little dwell time on this then.
Yeah.
Good. And did we move the amendment yet?
Not yet.
Secondly, these great pictures and maps, are they part of Representative Quam's presentation, or where'd they come from?
Representative Quam, did you submit those, I guess?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I apologize. In color and with the full sheets, it's a little bit easier to see, but this is just a subset of the examples that were presented to me when I queried folks, and it's, you know, some in the metro, one in Rochester, which is near my district, not in there, but former Representative Queasley, when he was active on the committee, there was a Highway 52 project, fairly extensive, and it's been some years now, and this property, which you have a copy in, you can still see where the paths are for the parking lots. You can, at least in the color, see where there was, access, and you can see where the roads and right-of-ways are. So, you know, again, that's one of the things when I was driving around that started this bill, is I saw that there were some opportunities researching, have these examples, but without a good inventory and a set process, I didn't think we were effectively conveying some of these properties back onto the tax rolls, but stimulating the local economies across the state, because I think almost everybody has somewhere in their district, you know, some possibilities like this.
Representative Runbeck, you had a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, it occurs to me that, you know, there is, I don't know how many employees at MnDOT, but here we are looking at it as if we have to hire and add people to do this. And is that really what's going to take place, or,
Mr. Dodd.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the intent is to kind of squeeze this into our regular work.
Yeah.
Try to make it happen. We wouldn't be looking to add employees to do this work.
Well, Mr. Chair, then, sir, why do we show it as an expense? Why is it a new, you know, why is revenue required additionally to do this?
Mr. Dodd?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe there's an appropriation associated with the bill, but it's just showing what the cost is that we won't be doing to deliver our regular program. We'll be doing this effort.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Mazin?
Mr. Chair, and whoever would like to respond, I just want to make a few comments in terms of dealing with freeways, highways, any type of roads. 5 years is not a very long time, and I remember, or I've been told, when 35E first came into Eagan, the city council at that point wanted more than one access, and they were told nobody would ever come there, so they wouldn't do that, and obviously they didn't come back a number of years later to put in some more ramps, etc. And also, one of the things where we now have our transit station, that was extra property, and we couldn't get the bus station into the developments, so we ended up using the extra property. And so, I guess my concern is that we need to be very, very conservative in how we do that, because I'm on the impression that when you're originally buying the property, it's fairly cheap, and if something is going to be developed, and again, at the rate many of MnDOT's projects are going out 20 and 30 years, to buy property back is going to be hugely expensive. So I would just, at least that 5 years stretched out a little bit would be something I think would be appropriate.
Does that maybe do it? No, Enefka, we've got other items here, so I would like to, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry if you've already answered this because I did step out for a minute. This is just a follow-up on Representative Sundin. You said there were about 20 properties sold last year, and you didn't have a list, but do you have a dollar figure for how much they brought in?
Mr. Dodds.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that added up, but again, I could provide that to the committee if it was so desired.
Could you do it on the back of your cuff and figure out something kind of rough, or don't you know that? Oh, that's all right. I'm just kind of curious if it's, you know, $50 or $100,000. But anyway, you're going to get that information, so that's good. Representative Beard, you were going to move the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, yes, to move this along and get this to resolution, I'll move the HF, the 123DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wishes.
All right. Are there any more questions on that one? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. And I think we're probably to the point where we can, Representative Mazin would resume her motion that House File 123, as amended, would pass and refer to Transportation Finance Committee.
Okay. Again, so moved.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, you're on your way to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Well, next, we have an overview of the General and Business Aviation Minnesota. We have the Acting Director of MnDOT's Office of Aeronautics, and I don't know how to pronounce your name.
Mr. Chair, it's Jay Hippus.
Hippus?
Yes.
I never would have guessed. Okay. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. I am Jay Hippus. I'm the Acting Director of MnDOT's Aeronautics Office. I'm going to give a brief presentation and overview of our office and some of our functions. The state aviation system is comprised of 135 airports. 126 of those are in Greater Minnesota, and 9 of those are in the Twin Cities metro area. 7 of those airports are MAC airports. They include Minneapolis, St. Paul, Crystal, Lake Elmo, Anoka, Blaine, Flying Cloud, and Air Lake. and there are two non-MAC airports. They are South St. Paul and Forest Lake. Of the 135 airports, 97 of those airports are eligible to receive federal funding from the FAA, and 38 are only eligible to receive state funding. Yeah. The 97 airports are also eligible to receive state funding also. There are currently 8 airports with airline service. These include Bemidji, Brainerd, Duluth, International Falls, Minneapolis-St. Paul, Hibbing, Rochester, and Thief River Falls. St. Cloud has recently also added air service. They are getting 2 flights a week from Allegiant Air. Of the 8 airports, 5 of these also do qualify for essential air service from the federal government. Back when deregulation happened, there was a plan in place to make sure that airline service was not lost to some key critical airports. So 5 of those do receive additional grants from the FAA, and those are Bemidji, Brainerd, Hibbing, Thief River Falls, and International Falls. There are currently approximately 12,000 licensed pilots in Minnesota, and we have approximately 6,000 registered aircraft. Of the 6,000, about 4,200 are paid aircraft registrations that we take in as revenue. The remaining gap are ones that are exempt by state statute. There are some aircraft that are no longer flying. Those are not required to pay on it. And there are some that have been destroyed or taken out of commission. So roughly 4,200 are actually revenue-generating registered aircraft in Minnesota. Back in 2011, we took in 31 million commercial passengers. And the state actually owns 150 state-owned navigational aids. These are primarily at the rural airports. These include lighting systems, navigational systems, and various types of weather systems that we maintain and operate. This is just a kind of a quick overview map of the airports that we have out there. There are key airports, which basically have a 5,000-foot runway, and those are able to handle support business jets and regularly scheduled air flights. Those have, of course, the longer runways, at least 5,000 feet. We have approximately 30 of those when you count the airports with key commercial service. We also have our next category is intermediate airports, and these are less than 5,000 feet in runway. They can they are paved and lighted, and they can accommodate some jets, but typically are more the propeller-type planes, single-engine aircraft and multi-engine aircraft that come into those. Then there are also landing strips, and those are identified in green around the state. These are more turf runways, and they're only operational for various times of the year. For example, in the winter months or when it's raining, those airports and runways do not typically function. This is from a study that was done by the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies back in 2011. And airports roughly have an impact of $12.3 billion in economic activity to the state, and roughly 164,000 jobs are generated. Now, these are both indirect and direct results. Of business aviation or aviation impacts. Aviation is an important part for business, both in general aviation and for the airlines, agricultural, medical, firefighting and law enforcement, especially in the northern areas where firefighting is key, and cargo throughout the state. I'm just going to give you a brief overview of MnDOT's aeronautics office. We currently have 39 employees, roughly in 6 different areas of it. The MnDOT aeronautics office is funded primarily through the State Airport Fund. Roughly $4.3 million last year went to airport development. This is primarily in grants to local airports. And $6.1 million goes towards support and services, which would be our operational budget, paying for our aircraft and those types of, and maintaining the navigational systems that MnDOT owns. For our airport development section, here we manage the state and the federal grants that are handed out. We oversee those grants as they're being implemented. In fiscal year 13, we provided $3.9 million in maintenance and operation grants to airports, $11.1 million in construction grants, and $2.3 million in navigational aids and improvements to local airports. And typically each year, we also administer the federal grants, which average between $50 and $60 million. It has gone up as high as in the 70s, back after 9/11, and as low as the 20s. We do have some fluctuation in the amount of grants that we handle through the federal government. Our planning area primarily deals with zoning for airports and approving those zoning requests, and also is responsible for our state aviation system plan, which we recently completed. The last day for public comment is today, and we will shortly be submitting that to the FAA for approval. Our air transportation group, we basically have 4 aircraft that MnDOT owns, 2 King Airs that we mostly fly around the governor and state staff and other DOT staff. We have 3 full-time pilots and 4 other pilots on staff who can also fly when we need to. So in 2012, MnDOT did actually 349 flights. We carried 1,158 DOT passengers and 134 non-DOT passengers. And this includes the governors. We also flew approximately 127,000 nautical miles in 2012. The other area of our office is the operations navigational systems. Here we maintain a lot of lighting systems at the airports, weather stations, and other navigational support needs. We also provide striping at certain airports. And we also perform airport and heliport inspections and licensing for all the airports. Our next area is education and training. Here we provide training to airport managers, maintenance technicians, commercial service promotion, and various other areas to encourage and promote aviation in Minnesota. And lastly, we do handle the aircraft registration through the Office of Aeronautics. All those payments do come through our office and are then deposited into the state airport fund. As part of our office, the 38 employees, we do have two information technology employees who are now going to be MnDOT employees. They handle a lot of our database and technical support for our office. That's a very quick high-level overview of our office, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Beard?
This is just an observation for you, Mr. Chairman. The Director of Aeronautics reminded me that they have two King Airs down there that are available to us as well. If you have a committee budget, Mr. Chair, and want to take a field trip when the weather gets nice, I'd be happy to ride along. We could go to, Duluth or something and tour the service factory. In fact, I think we did that my first year here. I think the commissioner took us in the committee, and we went around a couple different places. So it's a very educational trip. Makes us better legislators, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other questions? Concerns or what? Nothing. Well, I am going to ask then, thank you, and ask that Ron Razzelli and Dave Beaver. Rozell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Give your names for the committee record as you testify, please.
Sure. My name is Ron Retzel.
Retzel.
And I represent Bolton & Mink, the firm Bolton & Mink, which is a Minnesota-grown firm. We have 10 offices in Minnesota. We employ 280 employees here in Minnesota. We serve 225 municipalities, again, here in Minnesota. And we also serve 25 general aviation airports, which are in greater Minnesota. Okay. And with me is Dave Beaver.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Dave Beaver from the Owatonna-Degna Regional Airport in Owatonna, Minnesota. I've been an airport manager there for 17 years now, and wanted to support this effort to come raise some awareness about our airport.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're here to talk about the other 126 airports that are in Minnesota, primarily in greater Minnesota. Ms. Jay Hipson did a great job of detailing some of the aspects of our aviation system. In my presentation, I have some duplication, so I'm going to skip over that part of it in the interest of time and that. So first of all, again, here's the similar map that Jay had up. Of the 135 airports, and when I talk about the airports in Minnesota, I like to say that we're here representing a $12.3 billion business in the state of Minnesota. That's the economic impact that the 135 airports have within the state. Like Jay said, there are various types of airports, and I'd like to give you just a few examples of where they are, kind of relate them back to the various cities. First one is an airport landing strip, which simply is a turf runway used for seasonal. Cities like Winsted and Wells, North Home, and Big Falls all have the draft strip as their airport. Intermediate airports, essentially the backbone of the aviation system. Again, they're less than 4,000 feet, but they still serve single and multi-engine type of aircraft. Cities like Hutchinson and Blue Earth and Aiken, Faribault, Buffalo, Long Prairie would be similar airports. Then there's the key airports, 22 airports that are non-commercial or half commercial service, and then the 8 with commercial service that Jay mentioned. Again, they're 5,000 feet or longer. Cities like Alexandria and Brainerd, Mankato, Wilmer, and Worthington would be examples of those types of airports, along with Owatonna. There are just over almost 5,100 based aircraft in Minnesota at these specific locations, but what's interesting, if you compare this graph with where the aircraft are based, and then the next slide as to where the operations are occurring. So obviously the base aircraft are moving around the state quite a bit, as well as itinerant aircraft not only coming into the metro area, but a significant amount that spread uniformly throughout the state, nearly 1.7 million operations.
Does that mean that 5,000 planes plus military did 1,761?
Those 5,091 would be based aircraft. The 1.7 million would be operations of what we call both based aircraft and itinerant aircraft, aircraft that's coming from other states into the airports.
Thank you.
So, and an operation is a landing and a takeoff. That's two operations. Okay. We have a very well-covered state for medical operations. This is one of the key benefits of having an airport system as we do. And these airports are all-weather access for either medical, excavation, or transport flights. A great benefit throughout all the citizens of Minnesota. This is a population center of key airports within, or population within 90 miles of a key airport. Again, you can see how uniformly it is distributed throughout the state and serves the state well. These are the type of aircraft that are using the GA system, ranges from the Cessna 172 up to the Gates Learjet and the Falcon G200. The aircraft primarily on the right-hand side are business craft airport, primarily used for productivity. One of the key reasons why businesses use aircraft to Minnesota airports is because of the ease of travel and getting as close as you can to your destination, either to your factory or to your business, is very critical. Here's a sample of businesses located within cities throughout the state that are located in that city because that city has that airport. And you can go through and kind of you recognize a lot of these key businesses within Minnesota, as well as the number of people that they would employ as well. But the airports rely on investment, and you as the state of Minnesota has made a very strong investment into these airports, not only from planning to paving to lighting to buildings and navigational aids. A lot of this information that I have now is from the state aviation system plan that they're currently nearly done with that report. So just to give you a little snippet, this slide shows from 2005 to 2010 actually the deterioration of the pavements on these airports in general. The bonding bill that was passed 2 years ago did quite an effort to improve this condition here and help the pavements throughout the state. The State Aviation System Fund is a user-funded program. There is very little, if any, general dollars, state dollars that goes into the aviation fund, and they're from flight property tax to interest income, to aviation fuel tax, and then aircraft registration. And this is where the source of the funding is for nearly all the state grants. This is how it's parceled out. The state funds in 2011 was about 20% of the overall funds that the airports received. And then those funds went to the 135 airports. 97 airports that are eligible to receive federal dollars, and then the other 38 airports which rely solely on state funds. An average of where the state dollars were spent, primarily on construction. 66%, nearly two-thirds of it was spent on construction, either construction on the air side or construction on the land side. 24% is spent on just maintaining and maintenance, no plowing in that for the airports.
Is there local money that goes into these two?
Yes, there is. For federal dollars, there's 10% local money. It's a 90-10 match. And for state dollars, it depends on the airport. If they receive no other federal dollars, then it's an 80-20 match, 20% local. Otherwise, it's 70-30.
Where does the locals get their money? Property taxes?
Property taxes. There are revenue generation opportunities from the airport. They have their own sales tax. They have their own airport farm property and hangar leases. But most of that, though, comes from the general fund within the city.
Okay.
And so that's why it's very important about how they spend their money.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Beaver, again, from Owatonna. And just want to take a moment of your time today to talk a little bit about our airport. But so you know, there are, as you've seen, there's 135 airports in this state. Give you a feel for that, there's approximately 5,000 airports in the country in our category of airport. The airports that you may see that have commercial service, like the Minneapolis Airport, there's about 500 of those. So we serve a wider audience, a wider array of traffic, commercial use, business aircraft, business aviation use. But much like the other airports, we contribute to the millions of dollars in the 12.4, 12.3, 12.4 billion-dollar economic impact of this industry of general aviation airports in the state. Oops, going the wrong way. Our airport serves a number of types of aircraft. We see on a daily basis anything from single-engine aircraft to turboprops, twin-engine, jet gliders, hot air balloons, light sport aircraft. Very light jets is a new segment. But we see a lot of different aircraft that we accommodate at our airfield. And some of the uses, not just common to our airport, but to many of these airports, include corporate and business aviation. We see a lot of transits that come in from out of state, recreation, military, aircraft charter. You can read the list there. We see DNR, State Patrol, medical transport. We become a focal point of the community, such as in 2009 when we had the flooding in southern Minnesota. Much of the supplies and different surveying of the area came in through local airports like Owatonna and Wasika and some others in the area. I've listed here a number of companies that do currently utilize the Owatonna Airport. Not all of these are based here. Some are small, some are large. But they come in, not only these companies and their corporate flight departments, but others that are vendors or suppliers for businesses located in Owatonna. This represents a significant economic development tool for our community. It's very important to what those businesses expect when they come into our area. I want to leave you with just some benefits of the general aviation system in Minnesota and our airport in particular. We feel that it supports existing business needs. We are a key system airport. We're over 5,000 feet of runway, so we can accommodate the corporate and business aircraft. The economic development tool that I mentioned, when visitors come into our community, it's the gateway to our business community. It's the first thing people see when they come off that airplane. It's also the last thing they see when they leave our community. So we feel it's very important to have a good system of airports, and especially in Owatonna and our airport. Mentioned emergency services and the economic impact. We feel it brings in businesses, developers, and decision makers, and is good for our local economy. Feel there's a lot of opportunities in aviation as we see the federal projections on number of aircraft deliveries. We see that increasing. Number of hours flown is according to the FAA, supposed to increase about 2.2% the next 12 years. The airline and the aging pilot population and the number of hires to be brought into the system. So we feel like flight training and other uses of our airport will become more and more important, and those type of things that we're seeing in the industry. And lastly, I would just like to let you know that we do have a very robust system in Minnesota. We'd like to compliment our MnDOT Office of Aeronautics for what they do. We feel like it's critical for what we do there at the ground level at our communities, and so I wanted to comment that that is a very good system that you have in Minnesota. With that, I would stand for questions.
I was going to ask about that $15 million we sold. Was that from this pool of money that is raised? Representative Beard, you have a better history.
Mr. Chair, yes. The Department of Aeronautics, you know, gets its money from three pools of revenue, fuel tax, registration fees, and flatland property tax. And over the years, the legislature saw fit to have them spend a percentage of that every year, which left a surplus and which accrued in an account. And MnDOT Aeronautics put that in investments, and we actually had a revenue stream called investment income for a while. But in the 2003 legislative session, when I first got here, we were overdrawn in the current account by $360 million. And the administration went looking for money everywhere and found this $19 million, I think it was, Dave, it was $19 million pot of money in an investment account at Aeronautics. And so they took $15 million of that to help the checkbook balance just before June 30th. Since then, we've been working and paying it back. And Representative Dill and I are sort of the unofficial keepers of the record on how we're doing on that. Mr. Chair, at the moment, it's a little less than $4 million yet to make the fund whole. What we've done then, instead of raising taxes on the aeronautics users who put it there in the first place, is we've been doing general obligation bonding, geo-bonding for some projects, including, I think, on your report, Ron, Big Fork was one.
Right.
That we rebuilt that airport in order to save a manufacturing company and something near about 300 jobs there. We did some work in Duluth to help the federal match for the new terminal.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember a couple other, maybe the testifier can recall some other issues, other areas where we actually did bond to help rebuild that, some of the infrastructure and pay the fund back. So we're on our way. One more bonding session, we should have it made, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for these gentlemen? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really don't have a question. I just wanted to make a comment to Mr. Beaver. I have landed at that airport several times. It's been about 10 years. It's an amazing airport. You guys have done a great job down there. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you. And it's not just due to what we do in Owatonna. Like I said, the airport system and the state funding is very important to us. And I appreciate that comment.
You're not asking for any money then this year, no? You guys, not just your Owatonna.
Mr. Chair, maybe $4 million would be in order. No, we're not. No.
Okay. Any other representative? What?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hornstein. Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With some of these upgrades of these airports, is it your thought that at some point you would want to accommodate, you know, either the Saabs or the CRJs that the Delta uses, or some of the other regional airlines, you know, SkyWest or whatever? Is that in the cards? Do you work with does the state work with the local airports in order to lure them in, you know, the way the MAC does with Southwest or others? Is that kind of on the radar to get that type of service into these airports?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, most of the airports need to work within the Federal Aviation System Plan as well. Both the FAA and MnDOT have very stringent planning criteria for when an airport will be able to expand. It's called the justification for that type of expansion. In order to get funding for that type of expansion, they have to have justification. And that's documentation of certain aircraft that will come into a particular community. Most of the communities in the GA group are recruiting economic development businesses to come in, that type of thing. As far as the Saabs and commercial service, that's always an ongoing challenge, particularly for our existing commercial service airports like Bemidji and Thief River Falls and that type of thing. So those airports are touting that, but it'd be unlikely that many more airports would fall into that category based on the current status of the commercial service around within Minnesota.
Representative Hornstein.
Then, for example, St. Cloud, which I think they have Allegiant now, mm-hmm. and they're trying to get others. who actually then does the work to negotiate with airlines, and is MnDOT involved with that, or is that just entirely a function of the local St. Cloud Airport Authority or whatever it's called?
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question on that. My understanding is that, and Bill Tell up at St. Cloud does a great job working with his community and mayor. They do attend a lot of airline-type promotion events where they look for tenants. There is a federal grant available that they make use of called the Small Community Air Service Development Grant. And I do believe they work fairly closely with MnDOT Aeronautics as well, just so there's an understanding of what where those efforts are being directed. But I think it's primarily a local effort.
Thank you.
What's the requirement for me to put a landing strip in my property if I noticed up north there's several as I drive north that are grass strips. One of them, they're hours. Crop dusting planes taken on and off of, are they, is there a requirement to get a permit or something right there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you do need to be licensed, you need to license your airport with the state of Minnesota, and they do have specific criteria for a private airstrip that you would need. You would also need to evaluate the airspace around that proposed airstrip to make sure you're not in conflict with any other airport.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you qualified that, because I don't think Sunnyside Road would be wide enough even.
I don't even think
a Cessna could land on Sunnyside Road.
Any other questions or comments? Where we have Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, and whoever would like to respond, first of all, I'm glad to hear that Minnesota has a good system for our airports, but since jobs is really one of the things we're focusing on, how much competition is there, say, between Owatonna's airport and some of the other airports in Minnesota? And also, how do you, also the competition between perhaps your airport and some of the airports in the neighboring states?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Beaver.
Yes, the Owatonna Airport, I mean, I guess you could look at, say, Faribault as a competitor, for example, but really those airports are different needs for their own communities. We are more of a regional airport because we are a key system airport, so we can handle some of the larger aircraft that may fly into our community. Those passengers may then get off and drive to a different location close by. All of those airports within the state, those 135 airports, typically serve a different need. We have 50 based aircraft in Owatonna. We accommodate around 17 companies that fly in and out of the area, the airport for the area business use. Competition within states, I see that as being more and more important because of the way our system is set up and how we can take advantage of structuring our revenues to look at being more competitive, for example, for some of the employers at airports, some of those businesses that are larger employers in the state. I think that sort of thing should be looked at to remain competitive.
Does some of the companies like Schwann's and whatever other companies you have out of Owatonna participate in development costs and so forth?
Mr. Chair, one more time on the question, I guess. Private companies invested in the airport? We have a number of companies in Owatonna that do utilize the airport, but they're not necessarily direct investors of it other than through the general fund of the city of Owatonna.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in our family of airports, there are companies that do help offset some of the local costs in order to do that. Mainly because it's primarily their user and that type of thing. And so that when we help our clients put together funding packages, that's often part of that in order for them to make local funds, because most airports do not generate enough money to be self-sustaining.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can help out Representative Mason on a little bit on this. For when you're talking competition, especially when you're using local, for example, I manage an airplane that's out at NOCA, which I have to be on my way up there in about 2 minutes. The gentleman who owns the airplane asked me, why again are we keeping it up there based on the fuel price? And that's where I'm going to go with this. And I said, the difference between Anoka and Flying Cloud is a dollar. The difference between Anoka and downtown St. Paul is $2 per gallon. So it can be significant. You know, so when out in the country, in the greater Minnesota, the price can vary. The next step for competition can come state to state. Minnesota's aircraft registration is phenomenally high. It's off the scale compared to the other neighboring states. Some aircraft categories, it's up to 10 times the amount. So sometimes, and I've seen this lately, where aircraft companies and owners are moving their airplanes over to Wisconsin to save thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. So when we're talking competition, it can be between cities and states. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you very much for giving us a treat here on. I'm waiting for Beard to talk about this, but he never does, so we thought we did bring in the experts. Or the other experts.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
While Mr. Hoff is coming, let me just point out, too, that one of the things that makes our state competitive, and MnDOT does a very good job of, is building and maintaining the instrument landing systems at the airport. On a nice day like today, you can fly to any airport in the state and do just a fine job. But whenever it's a really snowy, crummy day like it was the other day, people that are coming here, like for Target or Best Buy or Super Value, they need to come and go, just like the big airport, Minneapolis-St. Paul, does. And many of these airports that MnDOT has helped build, like Owatonna, for instance, have all-weather capabilities, and you can land in some pretty crummy weather at an airport like Anoka or Marshall. Schwann's, you're right, Schwann's has been a big contributor at Marshall. The Mayo Clinic has done a phenomenal job of helping Rochester be an international airport. People fly to Rochester from the Middle East to go to the hospital there. And Mayo's helped build that airport. And the whole state aviation system is replete with examples like that. But MnDOT Aeronautics is coming up to speed very quickly with the new GPS landing systems. So we don't actually need to fix radio stations on the ground to help do the glide path and the localizer to help you find the runway. You can actually use GPS signals, but you still need the lights at the airport. So when you're down to minimum decision height, you can look up and see the bright strobes and say, oh, I found the airport, and land your airplane. And that's where MnDOT Aeronautics does a very good job of helping them design and acquire and build and maintain those systems. So, thanks.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Hoff, Minnesota Business Aviation Association, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Gordon Hoff. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. We've been organized as a organization since 1955. I would just like to compliment Ron and Dave. I thought they did an excellent job of giving you a good overview of what business, what aviation is, and touching on business aviation as well. In your folders, you should have a brochure that talks a little bit about the Business Aviation Association here in Minnesota, but I want to just draw your attention to what is business aviation, and it's the use of any general aviation aircraft for business purpose. The FAA defines general aviation as all flights that are not conducted by the military or scheduled airlines. Business aviation is part of the general aviation that focuses on business, use of aircraft, and helicopters. And we hear, so business aircraft, it's a tool. And if companies didn't find that it was a necessary tool, much like a computer or whatever else a company has, if you're making a product, you have equipment in your stores, aviation, the aircraft, is a business tool. It would not be there if it did not help the company continue to stay in business. You've heard and saw some of the different companies. I guess I'm going to be a little repetitive and tell you about some of the companies that are using business aviation. Back in May 8, 1920, Dayton Department Store flew in merchandise from New York City. The railroads were on strike at that time, but I'm sure that they used it a little bit as a marketing gimmick. But not today. Today, Target operates business aircraft to help manage their 1,763 stores and 37 distribution centers throughout the U.S. and Canada. Target does fly to 17 states in Minnesota to check on their stores' operations. One of the earliest operators of business aviation was General Mills. They started with a stint in Reliant in 1943. In 1946, because the executive saw the benefit of business flights, they bought a DC-3. Today they operate three international capable aircraft to do business with their suppliers in Europe as well as other states across the United States, or other states throughout the United States. In 1950, 3M bought two DC-3s to start their flight department. Today they fly five large cabin business aircraft, and they use them to operate in the state of Minnesota, every state in the United States, and throughout the world. They can fly directly from St. Paul Downtown Airport to Japan, nonstop, about 13 hours. Marvin Windows and Doors. They employ 2,200 people. About 2,000 of them are in Warroad, Minnesota, a town of 1,780 people, roughly. And they use their Beach 1900 to supply their staff and people who come to Minneapolis or come to Minnesota to do business with Marvin Windows. That's a long drive. If you've ever driven from Minneapolis to Warroad, you know that that can take a while. So they use their Beach 1900 to fly twice a day, Monday through Friday, into Minneapolis to put people on the airlines, take people off the airlines, and fly them back to Warroad. They also operate plants in North Dakota, Tennessee, Oregon, Virginia, and they serve customers in the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. All of that headquartered in Warroad, Minnesota. The Schwan Food Company, you mentioned them earlier. They employ about 2,500 people in Marshall, Minnesota, a town of about 13,000. And they fly two flights Monday through Thursday, one flight on Friday. And they have production facilities in Minnesota, Florida, Kansas, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Hormel Foods Company, Spam. We kind of think of that as something posing as meat, I think, but I grew up on a lot of Spam, and I kind of enjoy it yet today. They employ between 5,000 and 6,000 people down in Austin, Minnesota. They have operations in 10 states and 40 locations, have facilities in China, South Korea, and the Philippines, and operate two large business jets. Going back north, Polaris employs 2,150 people approximately in Roseau, Minnesota. They operate two King Airs, and they have facilities in Iowa, South Dakota, Wisconsin, international facilities in Canada, France, Australia, Poland, and Mexico. Fagan, a town of about 3,200, they employ about 175 people in Minnesota, with marketing offices in Louisiana, Nebraska, South Carolina, Washington State, and Hungary. These are just a few examples of why people have business aviation to be competitive and stay in business in Minnesota. Who are the passengers on these flights? A lot of commercials kind of point to the person going to a golf outing or some kind of fancy place. That doesn't happen. Most of these flights are carrying selection team to go find a site to expand their business, technicians to fix a problem, buyers for their products, or team leaders. Based on dialogue with our Minnesota pilots who use business aviation, about 1% of their flights are for business slash personal use. So the idea that it's not a working piece of equipment is very misleading. Again, if it didn't make sense for the company to operate that airplane, they wouldn't have it. And today's business aircraft is a traveling office. Employees on board can freely discuss strategies, review their presentations and materials without anybody looking over their shoulder. They have internet connection and they can use their cell phones while they're flying. Business aircraft help businesses operate efficiently, effectively, and to be more profitable. It's not about the number of flights into an airport. We hear that a lot. How busy is your airport? It's the economic impact of each flight. One of our Minnesota-based companies has a small plant outside of Minnesota. They fly in there less than once a month. There's a distribution center there, though, that employs 800 people. So without that airport, without that ability to get there and check on that distribution and do business quickly and directly, there wouldn't be 800 jobs in that community. So typically, companies look for airports that are within 15 to 20 minutes of their destination. As they say, time is a commodity that we cannot make more of, so you want to use it wisely. As was mentioned, there are about 5,100 airports in the United States. About 500 have commercial service. But of that 500, about 30 carry just about 80% of all traffic of the airlines. And they are located, a lot of them on the East Coast, two in Texas, three in California, one in Minnesota, one in Denver. And if you look at that map, it's kind of hard to get to Nebraska or Kansas or Montana if you're flying on a commercial airline. So business aircraft fills that gap and allows you to get there quickly and close to your destination. On average, each segment of a business aircraft saves you about 3 hours of flight from a commercial carrier. If we look at the commercial flight, we arrive about an hour early to get through TSA, pardon me, and get on your flight. Then you have to deplane, navigate from the gate to the terminal exit. Using a business aircraft, you arrive 15 minutes before your departure time, land at an airport near your destination, and exit the plane quickly. So, an example, there's a Minnesota company that's going to depart Minneapolis at 0700. They're going to fly to St. Louis, Missouri. They're going to do business. They're going to get on the airplane and return to Minneapolis. They're going to leave St. Louis at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They're going to return to Minneapolis. They're going to change the flight crew out. They're going to fly that same airplane to Boise, drop off a passenger, fly to Portland, Oregon, drop off another passenger, fly to Sacramento, California, with the rest of the passengers who are going to have a meeting the next morning. I challenge you to do that on a commercial air carrier. And don't get the idea that the MBA or business aviation is against the airlines. When they go out with a business aircraft, they probably come back with more contracts or more business, and then there's going to be more people getting on the commercial carriers and going to do business in that community. So actually, we look at the business aviation tool as a generator of more traffic for the commercial air carriers. We know there are 135 airports in Minnesota. 8 of them are with commercial service. Business aircraft can use all of them except the turf runways. They're just a little short. In 1945, we talked a little bit about funding, so I'll get to that too. In 1945, the legislature, your predecessors, established the Department of Aeronautics, now the Office of Aeronautics. The revenue, as you've heard, is generated mainly from three things: aircraft registration tax, the fuel tax, and the flight property tax that the commercial carriers pay. These statutes were developed 68 years ago, and we are still operating under them. The MBA is working with the Minnesota Aviation Community, the Airport Council, the Minnesota Aviation Trade Association, and the commercial air carriers. We're working to find a way to update these, we think, outdated statutes that we live under, and, you know, reflect the capability and equipment of today's aircraft and the environment of business in the 21st century. We recognize the importance of all airports in the state of Minnesota. We certainly want to see them adequately funded. I'd like to draw your attention to a bar that we have in the in your folders, a graph, I should say. This one shows from 1976. I can go no further back and come up with good numbers for how much was generated from the flight property tax, which is the blue line. The red line is the aircraft registration, and the green line is fuel. The blue line, the flight property tax, has stayed fairly stable over the years. The fuel and the aircraft registration have changed places. Fuel, the tax on fuel is 5 cents a gallon. It was last raised from 4 cents to 5 cents in 1951. Now, I don't know if anybody other than you, Mr. Chair, and I are old enough to remember probably 1951 and what we paid for fuel. But I remember paying 20 cents a gallon for gasoline in my car. I got to believe that we were paying probably 50 cents for aviation fuel, and we were paying a nickel tax. Today, Mr. Beaver says he charges about $5.70 a gallon for avgas. They're still paying the nickel. So fuel hasn't changed. Whereas aircraft registration is based on the value of the aircraft. We pay 1% of the value of the aircraft in a sale registration tax. It drops over 7 years to 0.25%. We are the most expensive place to register an airplane in year one, and we stay in the top three forever. How do you change something that's 60 years old without creating some pain? That's been our challenge. So we have a bill that's coming forward. I'm not sure that it'll stop in this committee. It may or it may not. But we are looking to change the way we raise the funds to fund our great system of airports. And I can tell you that our pilots fly all over the world, and they fly all over the United States, and they always come back to Minnesota saying, this is one of the best airport systems in the country. So hats off to the people like Dave Beaver who are out there this last ice storm making it possible for a Learjet to land. I think it was a Lear, but whatever it was, he's out there scraping ice, and he's hooking chains onto wheels to break up the ice and whatever he can do to make that airport landable for an aircraft. And they diverted from Faribault because they couldn't get into Faribault, but because he had a longer runway, he went out there and made it land, made it available and safe to land that aircraft. So we have great people working to make our airport system what it is today. One last data I'd like to bring to you. I'm looking for a clock. Are we running out of time?
5 minutes.
Okay. In FY12, 5.3% of the aircraft registration, or 5.3 of the aircraft located in Minnesota, based in Minnesota, out of the 4,200 that pay to register their airplanes, about 225 airplanes paid 89.5% of the registration tax. That means that 94.7% of the airplanes registered in Minnesota paid 10.5% of the tax. So it's getting out of balance. We'd like to see some balance put back into it. I'll quit by saying, if you build a mile of highway, you can drive a mile. If you build a mile of runway, you can travel around the world. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. When we had a representative here, used to fly with Marvin Windows back and forth. Mm-hmm. When they came in, Maxine Pennis. No longer with us on this earth. But anyway, that was the way she got home. Over the weekend, whereas she probably would have driven all weekend back and forth.
Mm-hmm. She was where do the jets
that can that some of the leisure companies have that can leave Minnesota to the Orient in one swoop? Where do they base those? Or what kind of runways and so forth?
I'm not an expert pilot on that, but usually if you're flying a large cabin business aircraft, it's going to need probably 6,500 feet runway to be usable in all kind of weather. You could probably shorten that on a good day with dry pavement and a light load down to 5,500. But they're going to need the longer runway, and those aircraft are going to be at MSP. They're going to be Duluth with a 10,000-foot runway, yeah, or St. Paul, right, with a 6,500-foot runway.
None of the other Flying Cloud or whatever.
In the wisdom of the legislature a few years back, they passed a law that limited all other airports to 5,000 feet or less, okay, in the metro area. And so they find it challenging to move business aircraft onto those because, yes, on a good, clear day in the summer that's not too hot, they can use it, but on a day like yesterday, they would not be able to use that airplane on those airports.
Well, does that lead to overcrowding of the main airport here then, or what? No?
Years ago, the Metropolitan Airport Commission upgraded St. Paul and invited and encouraged people to leave. Some did, some didn't. Flying Cloud is now expanded to 5,000 feet. I know that there are some people looking at that because it does give a little bit more length. Anoka has a large brand new FBO up there called Key Air. They are at 5,000, but he's also limited. He gets medium size, and on some good days he can get some large cabin aircraft in there, but typically they're the medium-sized jets and down.
Any other questions or comments?
Just comment, Mr. Chair, that the city of Mankato actually expanded their runway in order to be able to leap the ocean and go straight to Europe for a prospective business they had there. And the city of Marshall, Schwann's and the state combined to put that runway at 7,000 feet, I believe, so they can do business in Japan, the Philippines, and the Orient nonstop from Marshall, Minnesota. So yeah, it takes 6,700, 7,000 feet in order to comfortably and safely operate jets with that much fuel on them.
Any other questions, comments? I don't think there's any other business. We thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's adjourn.
Thank you.